report of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable Chief Justice David Gilbertson presiding, is now in session.
Good morning. The case for oral argument this morning is Adjutant, is that correct?
Adjutant,
thank you. Versus Jackley. For the appellant, we have Ms. Rebecca Mann and Ms. Mann is from Rapid City, and then Mr. Alan Simpson from Kansas City. Welcome. And for the Attorney General, we have Ms. Patricia Archer from Peer, an Assistant Attorney General. With that, Mr. Simpson, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, opposing counsel. The South Dakota legislature has instructed the Attorney General to prepare a ballot explanation, and that ballot explanation consists of both a title, well, it's a ballot statement, and it consists of a title and an explanation of a proposed measure. Now, the plain language of South Dakota law provides that the Attorney General's ballot explanation must educate the voters of the purpose and effect of the proposed measure. To that end, the legislature's also clearly given us an action in order to test that. The action, quote, is to challenge the adequacy of the statement. And that's a clear command. It's a precise command. It focuses the issue for what this action should test. And it's truly the question of whether or not the underlying statement is adequate. This case arises because it's not always clear what the purpose and effect of a statute is. Sometimes proponents will draft something which is misleading or may require reference to either other laws or other facts. So, for example, oftentimes we see proponents try to create a statutory construct in something that sounds positive. For example, it might be community, solar, equity credits. And then what this creates is a situation where the court is struggling, or the Attorney General struggles, to actually define what this is. This is a similar case because what we have is a 36% cap on short-term lending. But this quote-unquote cap bears no resemblance to the economic realities of short-term lending as defined under South Dakota law. We believe that this case boils down to three basic issues. First, we need to understand what are the precise contours of this certiorari action that Ms. Adjutant has filed. There are certain statutory constraints that the legislature has imposed upon this action, and although the court has a line of cases, analyzing the standards by which this statement must be judged. The standards have changed over time, as was clear in the AFL-CIO versus Jackley case. Additionally, we have, even since the effect, since the date of that case, new legislation or amended legislation in the form of 12 South Dakota codified laws 12-13-9.2, which we believe, which certainly was not mentioned in the Jackley case, and we believe informs us as to the legislature's intent, and the plain language tells us sort of what that action should look like. Second, we should wonder, postulate, why is this case the unique case that would cause us to look beyond the actual four corners of the document, the four corners of the initiated measure? And third, we should also look and see why that expected procedure, what we would ordinarily expect as the test for an underlying ballot explanation action, how that procedure broke down in Ms. Adjutant's case, and why we didn't get the right result. So, as I mentioned, the basic framework for how this would work is that an opponent of the measure, or someone who feels that the Attorney General's statement did not actually convey the purpose and effect of the statute, would file an action for a writ of certiorari. Now, the statute makes no mention of the term certiorari, but South Dakota courts' long line of cases have denominated this as certiorari. And so to that end, that's what Ms. Adjutant did. She filed her action for certiorari, but and it's not... there's nothing inappropriate about categorizing this quote-unquote action as a writ of certiorari, because a writ is simply a form of an action. It makes sense in order to think of it in that construct.
Well, however, the legislature did not go so far as to say this is not a writ of certiorari.
That's
so one would assume, given our line of cases, it still is, correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chief Justice. We believe it is a writ of certiorari, and that's precisely why we filed a writ of certiorari at the lower court. However...
But, you know, the statute doesn't say that. The statute says an action to contest the adequacy of the ballot. It doesn't say certiorari. It doesn't say what the nature of the action is.
Yes.
You chose certiorari. And as lawyers always do, because it's comfortable, that's what the prior cases have been involving. But here, does it make a difference that this new statute doesn't mention certiorari?
We don't believe it does make a difference, and we would trace that back to the old case of Austin versus Eddy. Now, Austin versus Eddy has been cited by both cases, but by both parties, but neither party cited Austin versus Eddy for the precise fact that a court, or excuse me, the legislature can change the scope of the writ on certiorari. That's in Austin versus Eddy. It says, you know, there are various other states that have changed the scope of the writ in an action for certiorari, and that's what we believe the legislature has done in this particular instance. Now, certiorari at equity, as has been codified under the South Dakota laws, has a various set of, you know, standards. Those are generally applicable to writ of certioraris, but the specific governs the general in this case in particular, because what we have is an action which we all understand to be certiorari and which was never mentioned that it's not certiorari. So I think we can assume that the legislature understood that the action would be certiorari, but it says specifically that the action tests whether or not this is the purpose and effect is properly in the actual statement. So there's not sort of this discretion, you know, was there malfeasance? Was this, you know, just so grossly unfair that we would never, that certiorari must lie? What we have is an actual affirmative command that we have to decide whether or not this captures the purpose and effect of the statute. This is also broken down, you know, by the fact that South Dakota law provides for judicial notice in certiorari proceedings as well as other sorts of proceedings. The specific words that the legislature has used is, you know, judicial notice shall be appropriate at any stage in the proceedings. It doesn't say only in cases, you know, that are not certiorari, only on prohibition and not in... and not mandamus, or, you know, any one of the various different ways that the legislature could have qualified that. And we think that both legal research in the form of understanding the general framework that these short-term loans operate under, the fact that they are required by law, every type of short-term loan mentioned under this must be less than 6 months. Every title loan must be a month or less. A payday loan is typically 2 weeks. So those are the sorts of basic economic facts, legal research, that we would expect the court, absent judicial notice, to be able to look at, to understand, even under the old standard, the legal effect. What we have now...
Then you're talking about a trial de novo. If you're going to let in research and studies about effects and rates of return and costs and this type of thing in this business, you're talking about a trial de novo.
Your Honor, we believe that we're not talking about a trial de novo for two reasons. First of all is that nothing that the Attorney General has done could really be considered a trial in the first instance. The second point that I would say, you know, these single officer determinations are not quote unquote trials. We had to fight in order to get evidence that we had previously presented actually included as a part of the record. The other point that I would make on that is that we have a situation where, you know, what we're arguing, I don't think any court would ever call reference to other laws a trial de novo. Certainly, appellate courts.
It doesn't matter what you call it. You're asking for the court, the trial court, to be able to consider basically any evidence that you might have relating to this and decide it anew.
Now, Your Honor, we believe that we don't want a dueling battle of the experts. That's not our argument. Our argument is simply judicial notice and other laws. And we believe that we win if we have those two things.
But on judicial notice, following up on Justice Inner's question, short of the state stipulating that your studies are accurate, how do you avoid the dueling experts or the court having to make findings of fact about which side is accurate? I mean, I haven't seen a stipulation from the Attorney General saying, we agree.
Yeah, well, we certainly haven't seen contrary evidence, Mr. Chief Justice. And there are some facts which are different depending on exactly what you're categorizing. So, for example, we could say, well, you know, whether or not this is an economic ban, what is the average rate at which this loan occurs? That would be something that is, you know, perhaps beyond the precise construct of judicial notice or would require a little bit more. But what we can say is that we understand businesses have certain costs. Businesses have to pay rent. You know, businesses that operate storefronts have to pay rent. They have to pay employees. There are things like the minimum wage. This is off by orders of magnitude, such that we don't need to know the precise amount of whether or not the operating cost for a loan is $12 or $13. We simply know that for a payday loan, the operating cost is more than $1.68, which is what a $100 loan would give under this. So, for example, we also know what's gone on in other states. We've seen this exact thing happen in other states. This isn't the first time that this precise sort of measure has been applied. Now, some other states are different, and if you look at the underlying statistics, which I believe are not subject to reasonable dispute, where we talk about the actual number of operating storefronts, those individual statistics show, and for example, Montana shows, that this sort of action shuts down payday loan stores and short-term lending.
So what are you saying the Attorney General did wrong? I couldn't figure it out.
What we're saying the Attorney General did wrong is that the Attorney General did not describe the proponents or the initiated measures, purpose, and effect. Now, that's evident by the fact that the number could have been one of various different things. It could have been 36, 37, 38, 50, 70, 100. But whenever you set a price ceiling in a complicated market that is so grossly below the marginal marginal cost.
You're asking us to take judicial notice of that. I have no idea if it's grossly below or not. That takes additional evidence.
Well, we presented the court with additional evidence, and we made clear that we weren't asking for all of the specific conclusions in those expert reports. What we were asking for is for the court to take judicial notice of some of the underlying facts. We don't need to get to all of the different conclusions, and a lot of it's common knowledge that whenever the cost of providing something is grossly in excess, you know, the actual expert conclusion part of that we don't think is specifically.
We have said in several cases we're not a literary review board.
Absolutely.
So we are not going to rewrite this.
Absolutely, Your
Honor. So what kind of relief are you seeking?
Your Honor, what we would seek is that the court, and this gets to one of the underlying issues, which is that a writ of certiorari was never granted in this case, although sort of you would not understand what the procedure was by looking at South Dakota law at the lower court. But what we would ask is that the court vacate the ballot statement, vacate the ballot explanation and title, and that the Attorney General can go over and, you know, give us something that explains to the voters the purpose and effect of the statute, which is beyond sort of, you know, it's not a political argument to say that this bans.
You've got to be more specific than that. You can't just say it's got to go back to determine the purpose and effect. He had that requirement the first time.
Absolutely.
What specifically do you want him to say?
Well, we've said exactly what we would like, and we've told the Attorney General what we would like for the statement to say, which is that
What does the law require him to say?
The law requires him to state the purpose and effect, which is, you know, so I think that...
Which is what?
Which is that the measure bans short-term lending. There's no actual... There's no basis in reality. The 36% number is just something sort of grasped out of thin air in order for the people to say, well, you know, maybe these loans might...
Yeah, don't you have an opportunity on the ballot to have your statement of what you feel the effects are?
On the ballot? I don't believe that we do, Your Honor, on the ballot. What our statement is that it's beyond political argument, and that the legislature has given us an affirmative obligation, has given the Attorney General an affirmative obligation to educate. And that didn't necessarily have to be the way that it is. In other states, the Secretary of State may do it. There may be various other state entities that are involved. And so South Dakota law is, you know, a little bit unique in that we ask the Attorney General to author the ballot explanation. Now this...
Why isn't your material more appropriate for educating? Because you're trying to educate the voters is what you're telling us, right?
That's what we believe.
Isn't that more appropriate then for TV commercials, letters to the editor in the newspapers, pamphlets, that discourse, which occurs in any election? Why isn't this more appropriate for that than putting it on a ballot?
Because the South Dakota legislature said it was appropriate to put on the ballot. It said that this statement must educate the voters to the purpose of an effect.
What standard are you saying we should apply to the Attorney General's writing?
What we're saying is that we believe that if the purpose and effect of a measure is discernible, you know, if it requires reliance on comparing other laws and facts not subject to reasonable dispute, items of judicial notice, what's occurred in other states, that we believe that that should be enough. And, you know, there's nothing inappropriate about this action. This action has a legislative basis that we anticipate that the Attorney General may not get it right every time. And it's
well, my question is, do we use an abuse of discretion standard when reviewing the Attorney General's explanation?
We believe that that's appropriate, Your Honor.
Okay, the Attorney General said that this measure limits interest rate to 36%. So you're saying we need to find that that's an abuse of discretion?
What we're saying is that it doesn't convey the purpose and effect. And that's, you know, whether there's certainly discretion involved. And as the Chief Justice mentioned, you know, this is not a literary review board. But actually, to probably correct my statement, I mean, we believe that there's no middle ground as to whether or not the statement complies with the law or doesn't. So in that respect, I do believe there would be de novo review. So I'll correct my misstatement. But we certainly acknowledge that there's a wide degree of discretion in authoring the statement. You know, in terms of legal consequences, this court has stated that there is particular discretion for that narrow issue as to whenever the Attorney General is truly acting as the state's lawyer as opposed to, you know, just an ordinary sort of statutory officer that, you know, could be a different statutory officer if the legislature so believed.
Did I hear you just say that the trial court should exercise de novo review on adequacy?
On adequacy, yes. We believe that that is what the statement, we believe that that's what the plain words say. If we look at the plain language of South Dakota law, you know, what we have is we sort of have the tail wagging the dog in certain instances here where we say, well, we're in certiorari, so we have to, you know, give all of this discretion. And whenever we deviate away from the plain language of what the legislature said, we feel like that's inappropriate. And so the question is really narrow. It is, does this language, and I have it in quotes, you know, it's an action to challenge the adequacy of the statement, and we believe that that's a real action.
Well, if the trial court exercises de novo review, do we also exercise de novo review?
We believe that at this point, that you do have an opportunity in order to say whether or not the trial court. Actually, Your Honor, no, I don't believe that you do. So I don't believe that you would exercise de novo review over the trial court's determination in that action. Because that action is specifically mentioned, that I don't believe that this court would offer that sort of...
Well, if the trial court exercises de novo review, then the Attorney General has no discretion really whatsoever.
And I think that that's apparent if you actually read, for example, Cole 1, what we come back to, whenever officers have clear statutory duties, the entire certiorari process goes down to, you know, did the officer exceed his discretion? Was his exceed his jurisdiction? Well, if his jurisdiction was clearly established, what we ultimately get down to is, did the officer's actions comply with the law? And so regardless of whether or not we're under certiorari or under this action, the ultimate question is simply whether or not it complies with the law. So we don't believe that that's really a great leap. And, you know, so, you know, I think that, sorry, I believe my time's up.
I believe it is, too. Sorry. The lights aren't quite working. That's why we've got a yellow still instead of a red, but I guess it's all zeros, so your
Thank
time
you,
is up. Thank you, Mr. Simpson.
Pretty red to me.
No, it's really colored lights. Oh. It turns on red when it's done.
I would look
to help people like me. Okay, Ms. Archer. Now that we've worked over the light system here, go ahead and you've got 20 minutes.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. Last April, a ballot measure sponsor submitted the final version of a proposed initiated measure to the Attorney General as required by statute before that measure could be placed on the petition for circulation. That's pursuant to STCL 1213.25.1. Now, the measure imposes a 36% cap on the amount of interest that certain money lenders can charge on their loans. The Attorney General then prepared and submitted a ballot title and explanation as also required by that statute, and filed it with the Secretary of State.
Is there an opportunity for input from the parties that have a concern on this issue? Were they the other side offered the opportunity to request certain words in the explanation, or does the Attorney General just do it on his own?
Well, I think there's two answers to that question, Your Honor. First of all, the statute does not specifically call for a procedure that contemplates submissions by, you know, any interested parties. And at this point, we're presuming that we have a side. At that stage of writing, there are no sides. The Attorney General is writing it on behalf of the entire citizenry of South Dakota. So there's no process that contemplates that. But secondly, I guess kind of tangentially to that, certainly the Attorney General of the state of South Dakota can't preclude anyone from submitting anything they want to his office. But as far as what is the process for what goes into the drafting of that explanation, and then ultimately, in the case of a certiorari challenge, what gets certified to the circuit court, those become two entirely different issues. So...
Can I ask you about the certification question? In your view, what should constitute a certified record? Should it be what the AG had before him at the time of the drafting, or whatever information and exhibits that the proponent wishes to offer?
Well, Your Honor, I believe the process that was utilized in this case is one that works quite well, and that is, the Attorney General certified, once the case was sued out in circuit court, as a certiorari, the Attorney General looked to the certiorari statutes, did a verified return, and certified the documents that were relevant to the inquiry, and that is the measure that was submitted to the Attorney General and the Attorney General explanation that was created for it. Those are the appropriate documents, and the reason for that is what is contemplated by the statute. 1213.25.1 says just that the sponsor submits the measure and the Attorney General submits the explanation. And so that's why the Attorney General certified those two documents. In this particular case, once we were in circuit court and the certiorari, the issue of whether or not something should be judicially noticed, you know, became an issue.
I got a question for you on that. As the attorney for the Attorney General, do you stipulate those documents are accurate?
No.
Right.
I think it is beyond that. I mean, in order for something to be judicially noticed, which,
if you stipulate they're accurate, I assume we could then judicially notice it. That's why I'm asking you, do you stipulate they're accurate?
No, we do not. All right. Attorney General does not. But we also object to the fact that the court, we object to them being judicially noticed as well, because they did not meet the standard for judicial notice. They are not subject to no dispute. And I think that, you know, one can just look at the documents themselves to see that. But even stepping back a little bit, Appellant Adjutant submitted those documents for their legal conclusions. That's what she swore out in her affidavit. She attached these 130-some pages of documents to her affidavit and said, I'm doing this because I believe that I agree with their analysis and their conclusions. So she didn't submit them for their facts. That only came later once the issue arose. So then you look at them, you know, on that basis. She still fails in that regard because she did not present them in any kind of matter that would allow for a reasonable judicial notice review type scenario. She simply referred to all 130 pages and said, here, take judicial notice of this. That's not the way you ask a court to take judicial notice.
The court did take judicial notice of a couple of letters, right?
Or
made them part of the record?
Yeah. The one letter was Exhibit 5, which was attached to the affidavit, and that was actually the Attorney General's transmittal letter to the Secretary of State. And, of course, there was no dispute about that, and so that was properly included. The other letter was a letter that Adjutant's current counsel, Sarah Frankenstein, submitted in 2013 to the Attorney General on behalf of some client, not designated in that document. And it relayed her position as to a prior measure that was circulated or being proposed at that time as a possible initiated measure that was very similar to this one. But the court did take judicial notice of that over the state's objection.
So the trial court didn't mistakenly think that it couldn't take judicial notice, right?
Oh, no. No, and the court recognized the principle of judicial notice. The trial court simply found that the Adjutant's exhibits did not meet the standard of proper judicial notice, and that would be the state's position as well here. I mean, even if you look at the documents themselves, some of the facts in there are equivocal. Some of the facts, frankly, don't even add up and cause you to leap from those documents to this ultimate conclusion that the plaintiff wants here. And what is that? I mean, they kind of hedged a little bit, but the bottom line here is that the appellant wants this Attorney General explanation to state a very absolute statement, and that is that the initiated measure, if adopted, will eliminate short-term loans in the state of South Dakota. And the issue is whether or not the Attorney General's failure to include this statement or even something similar to it, you know, was such an abuse of discretion that the ballot explanation simply does not meet the statute. And we would submit, of course, that the answer to that is no. And
back to judicial notice.
Yes.
Before you get too far away from that, do I understand your position then today that as an abstract matter of law, judicial notice is appropriate in this kind of case, just not to the documents that are involved here?
I think that's a fair, yes, I think that's a fair statement, Your Honor, yes. There may be certain times where properly judicially noticeable facts are appropriate.
In a certiorari matter.
In a certiorari.
Okay.
Yeah, of a ballot explanation case, yes. But here, you know, the question, and counsel, I mean, they don't seriously dispute what was actually written by the Attorney General. The heart of this case is whether or not the Attorney General's explanation should have said more. And we submit that the court should reject Edgerton's arguments, because when you're talking about whether or not the Attorney General should have put something else into the ballot statement, Edgerton has to show at a minimum that what she wants the Attorney General to include is itself meets the statute, and she fails for at least three reasons. One, it's not indisputably true. Two, it's selective, and three, it's advocacy. And what the Attorney General did put in the ballot explanation met all of the requirements of the statute. And he did what he was supposed to do, not only in drafting the statement, but also in the process below. And the starting point for that is the statute, 12.13.25.1. I think we all know what it says. You know, the Attorney General explanation shall be an objective, clear, and simple summary, a summary, mind you, to educate the voters as to the purpose and effect of the measure. It shall also include a description of the legal consequences, including the state's potential liability. So when you're looking at the language of a ballot explanation, a true and indisputable statement will go a long way towards being objective.
Would their requested material be fall within the definition of legal consequences? They're going to go broke if this passes? That's a legal consequence, isn't it?
It's certainly a potential legal consequence, Your Honor, but again, in the Attorney General's view, that kind of statement, and frankly, I have to look at just what it is they wanted us to say, and that's reflected by what they put into their affidavit, their application, I should say, as well as their brief, and that is that it will eliminate short-term loans. So that's what we've been dealing with here. And it's not indisputably true that it's going to eliminate short-term loans in the state of South Dakota. And we know that how? Well, first of all, look at the measure. The measure says nothing about banning or eliminating loans. You can also look, on its face you can tell it's not true, because just by looking at the statute that amends, 54-4, which deals with licensing of moneylenders, just by looking at the statute itself, you could say that the measure doesn't even apply to all possible lenders in this state, because some of those lenders are already exempted from the requirements of that chapter, that includes banks.
You'd have to agree that if you keep lowering that interest rate down at some point, it's a de facto death sentence for them. If it's 1% or something, you simply can't make any money at that level.
Your Honor, and this is kind of the dilemma with this whole kind of issue. And as it applies to this particular case, where we're talking about the drafting of a ballot explanation that's going to summarize what this measure does. Those kinds of facts are the kinds of things that, and one of you mentioned, I mean, that's the kind of thing that is potentially subject to dispute. At some point, what is the breaking point? I don't know what the breaking point is, but the documents themselves don't even explain what that breaking point is. And so what we get is we have a situation where the explanation is written, a challenge is made in certiorari, and now we're supposed to have these exhibits attached to the affidavit, which compels somebody. Now, is it the Attorney General? Is it some other interested party to come in and rebut that evidence? I mean, not only the statutes, but this court's case law does not contemplate that that is what certiorari is for. It is not to present evidence. It is not to have a battle of experts. It's not to have an adjudication of facts. That's clearly not what certiorari is about.
How do we then resolve what I think is a conflict between our law on the scope of certiorari and the statute, which gives the right to challenge the adequacy of the statement? It seems to me that the right to challenge the adequacy of a statement is totally in conflict with the well-established law on what you can do to challenge an official's act under certiorari. They don't. Under certiorari, you can look at jurisdiction and lawful authority, and that's as far as you can go. That's not even close to being able to challenge the adequacy of a statement. I just can't figure out how do you propose we resolve this apparent conflict?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that they are reconcilable, the principles of certiorari and this statute, which we're talking about 1213.9.2. And that was enacted in 2007, and you know, well after we've already had on the books statutes regarding the drafting of ballot explanations. What the legislature did with that statute, frankly, most likely in response to timing issues that had happened before, including in 2006. I mean, I believe you could look at that statute as more of a statute of limitations kind of substantive.
Well, it says challenge the adequacy of the statement. That's not a statute of limitations.
And then look at the standard for certiorari. You know, did the officer have the authority to do what he did? And, of course, clearly here that's not in dispute. He had the authority to write the ballot explanation. So then the next question is, did he exceed that authority? And how this court has interpreted that in the context of ballot explanation cases is whether or not he met the statute. And so that, in essence, is, can include a discussion of whether or not it's adequate. I mean, did the Attorney General...
We've often said, under certiorari, you don't get to challenge the propriety of the officer's acts. And what's the difference between that and challenging the adequacy of the explanation? I don't see a difference.
Well, Your Honor, I can only look to the court's most recent example of when it did just that, and that was in the AFL-CIO versus Jackley case in 2010, where this exact scenario played out. There was a measure being proposed. An opponent to the measure said, whoa, you know, I want something. We think that there should be something else added to this. You did not adequately, you know, educate the voters when you wrote this, Mr. Attorney General. And so they challenged it on certiorari. We had a certiorari hearing. It came up on appeal, and this court upheld it, saying, using the standard, saying, you know what, the trial court was right when it upheld the Attorney General's explanation. And so there was no irreconcilability in that.
Is the Attorney General's office taking a position? I understand in this case it was brought as a certiorari case. Do you have a position on whether or not it could be brought in another form based on the statute, just as a regular action, not an equity?
Well, to be honest, I'm not sure what type of action that would be. I think certiorari lends itself quite well to a ballot explanation review process. It's worked in the past. It's been workable. We've gotten to the point where we've got a process that is workable. And again, you know, certiorari does strike a balance. It allows for this court and the reviewing court to, you know, give the appropriate deference to the Attorney General that this court has already acknowledged is due. But it also allows the court to review and decide whether or not the Attorney General's statement as written meets the statute. And again, under the first certiorari, the question is whether or not the Attorney General did some act that was forbidden by law. And certainly, in the prior ballot explanation cases, we've had those kind of scenarios where there's been a statement written in the explanation, somebody challenged it, said you can't do that, and the court decided. Okay, so this is the opposite, where now we have a situation where they're not really challenging what was written, they're challenging by what wasn't. Okay, and that's the second component of certiorari review. Did the officer neglect to do some act that's required by law? And what, in this particular case, when it applies to ballot explanation reviews, you know, the court is going to have to decide, in order to reverse, this court would have to hold that it doesn't matter what the Attorney General actually wrote in the explanation, but that his failure to include this language was such an abuse of discretion that it did not meet the statute. We simply don't believe that that is the case here. And as you know, the court has held in the past, and I believe it's worth actually quoting. This court held in Schulte and reaffirmed in the AFL-CIO case. This court cannot be concerned with what the Attorney General should have said or could have said or might have said or what is implied or suggested by what he did say. Rather, the court must focus on the language chosen. Your Honors, we ask you that in this particular case that you uphold the explanation as written, that you uphold the process that was used here both at the Attorney General level and at the Circuit Court level, and affirm the case below.
Thank you, Ms. Archer.
Thank you.
Mr. Simpson, you have 10 minutes for rebuttal, sir.
Mr. Chief Justice, we do not believe that the problem with the Attorney General's explanation is that the Attorney General didn't say enough or should have said something a little bit differently. We believe that the actual effect of this measure, the effect in fact, which we believe the Attorney General is required to put in his explanation, is not in the statement as drafted.
Counsel, wouldn't your proposed statement that the measure would eliminate short-term loans in South Dakota, isn't that somewhat speculative?
No, it's not. Your Honor, we don't believe it's speculative because it's occurred in other states. We can look at other states that have enacted this exact sort of 36% cap, and that's detailed in the materials that were provided. And we see that whenever this sort of price ceiling in this industry is put in, it completely eliminates the product. And it's not an abstract sort of, you know, hard question. It's, you know, if you're going to loan somebody that you don't know on an unsecured basis $100 for a couple weeks, what sort of general frame of return does that require? You know, is it more than a dollar? Well, if it's more than a dollar, that means that the effect is not properly stated because this is an economic ban on certain activity. And what you have to do is you have to consider the actual term of the loans. And so because the effect is not anywhere in the statement, that's why it's not correct. We believe that the Attorney General could author a statement that didn't have 36% because 36% simply doesn't have any basis in reality. It's an attempt to frame the debate in order, 36% to the average person sounds reasonable. It sounds sort of like maybe some loans will be above that, maybe some loans will be below that. But whenever you actually consider the market, consider the term of the loans, it's simply not true. It's and it requires an extra step. It's not like, you know, a 5 cent price ceiling on ice cream. The average voter could look at that and say, well, wait, I know that that doesn't mean that everybody's going to, you know, lower the price on ice cream to 4 cents or 5 cents or whatever. Whenever it's a complex financial product, we believe that that makes it different. It's like saying that there has to be 0.36 basis points in a stockbroker transaction. Now, the average voter may not understand what a basis point is or that 0.36 basis points would be 36 ten-thousandths of a percent. So whenever you frame the debate in this way and you craft a misleading statement, it would just naturally lead to a sort of misleading valid explanation if you sort of look at the four corners of the document. And that's precisely why this action lies. The action lies because we expect that the Attorney General wouldn't always get it right. You know, we could triple the staff in the Attorney General's office and have a fact-finding team to understand what, you know, all the specific effects of every ballot measure. But we don't do that. We say, you know, that the Attorney General will generally get it right. And then in instances where the Attorney General doesn't, we provide an action and that the courts can figure it out and everyone can, you know, that's the process that we have. So I believe that, you know, we're not asking for the court to say more. in AFL-CIO versus Jackley, that really was more. It's like, you know, the AFL-CIO wanted the court to postulate or say, well, you know, in certain instances, somebody might waive this right that they otherwise have. These sorts of, you know, tangential collateral effects are not what we're after. There's direct evidence that this is the primary and predominant purpose and effect of the loan, to make loans longer term, for example, like credit cards. And people deserve to understand, we believe the law requires them to state that this is something that is actually going to be banned. And another,
did you just say that you're not asking that the explanation say more?
No,
asking that it say more.
We're asking that it says something different, Your Honor, because we don't believe that the actual statement itself is correctly stating the effect of the statute. Perhaps under a legal effects standard, that might be correct, but what the legislature did is they removed the word legal from the effect. This is the effect in fact. It's a sort of consequence. And these sorts of, a lot of the legal effects, you could think of it as sort of like a Venn diagram. You know, what's an effect? What's a legal effect? What's a legal consequence? There are some things that may well be all of the above. But there are certain, and in this case, the predominant effect in fact is not encapsulated in this statement. And we believe that therefore it's highly misleading, and you know that this is a sort of right that the legislature has conferred upon people. The Attorney General is supposed to educate the voters of the purpose and effect of the measure. And you know, the wisdom of that responsibility is not for Ms. Adjutant to decide. It's not for any of us to decide. It's that this actually requires the Attorney General to educate as to the purpose and effect. And so as part of that responsibility, we have to actually figure out what the effect in fact would be. And because this is off by orders of magnitude, we're not asking the court to take judicial notice of the precise number. We don't need to get there. What we can say is that this is so grossly understating the costs that we actually do know that. And that ties into the second point, which was that I think that if the court looks at the process below, it was anything but clear. It was anything but correct in terms of what actually should occur on certiorari. We have a preemptively certified record which sought to limit what the court could consider. And we never got a ruling on the judicial notice which we actually requested. If you look at the lower court's order, what it said was, we believe that these legal facts, opinion, you know, that these articles contain opinions from experts and therefore they're not appropriate for judicial notice. And by the way, judicial notice is never appropriate in a certiorari proceeding, you know, because that's what the Attorney General argued at the level below. So whenever you take those two rulings, what you never get is a ruling stating anything about sort of the underlying economic basic facts, what's occurred in other states where this has happened. That sort of general knowledge is plenty for this court to find that the actual effect, in fact, is that this measure bans short-term lending, and that, you know, saying 36% just doesn't have any basis in it.
You're saying bans. Do you mean that there will not be one lender left? Is that what you mean by ban, or do you mean a significant reduction? That's what I was asking about, whether or not there's a measure of speculation about what effect this will actually have on the market.
We believe that in a market, we have to assume that in the long run, at least, everybody's going to act reasonably or rationally. Now, there may well be people that don't act rationally. There may well be people who continue in the market with the hope that they will change the law under the short run. But in terms of the long-term effects, and certainly there are things in the articles that even discount that, because they say that the short-term marginal revenue, and I don't want to get too in the weeds on the economics, but the short-term marginal revenue, you know, of giving out the loan, just having the lights on in the place with somebody at the counter in order to make the loan, or the cost of running a credit report, that those are grossly over what the actual revenue from the loan is. So no rational actor would ever participate in the market. And that's what we've seen in other states. And, you know, that's the purpose and the effect of the measure is it's to make lenders give longer term loans under more affordable rate structures. And that's not short term lending. That's eliminating an entire category of state licensed lenders. And that's why, you know, Ms. Adjutant believes the effect should be stated, because this 36% figure simply does not encompass the effect of the measure. And with that, unless there are any other questions.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Simpson. Appreciate it. The court will be in recess until tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock.